that was not the real story. You know, I didn't take her off his hands.
You want to tell us the real story?
What? Well, I mean, the real story is that Ann and I met at a party, and I had known her before when she was with Sandy, and he obviously wasn't there, and I said to him, oh, where's Sandy? She said, I haven't seen Sandy for months, you know.
Mm.
We got it together, you know. But it was weird because, like, I didn't understand who she was and where she came from, right?
That's right.
And,
very wealthy woman.
She wasn't a wealthy woman. She didn't have a fucking dime to rub together. Her father, Dan London, was wealthy.
Mm.
And his wife, Claire.
But she grew up in the hotel. You mentioned
yes,
that.
Yes, she grew up in the St. Francis Hotel.
Yeah, what's the name of the cartoon? That's her story, some little girl in New York. You know, you mentioned...
Yeah, that's Memelman's you're talking about.
Yeah, the...
That was written by Ludwig Bemelman.
Bemelman's?
Yes,
yeah.
He wrote that story about the little girl. Yes, she grew up just like that.
But before talk about Anne, and Maya Angelou comes in your life before that, right?
Oh, you've got to. You got it. She was in between, right?
But the Jane, is it Bill Buck who takes Jane away from you? I got that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so yeah. He enters the commune.
You know, wait a minute. He doesn't take Jane away. Jane takes him away.
Well, okay, but he enters into the commune of you and Buckwheat and Jane, right?
He comes with one of the musicians from the Army Presidio band to rehearsal of Harry Parches. And this little guy, Richard, says to me, look, there's this guy. Little Richard was practically an East Coaster Jewish guy. He says, there's this guy who's in our band. He's not much of a musician, but he's crazy to get a position in the Harry Parson. See what you can do for him. And this is Bill Buck.
Who's only about 20 or so, right? He's young.
Maybe 19. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. He's young. And so I say to Harry, hey, this guy really wants to do something with that. And Harry says, no, we don't need anybody else. And the guy comes to every rehearsal, so about the third time he comes, I say, Harry, come on, you know, you can use him for something, can't you? He said, okay, let him turn the pages for the Chromalodeon. I said, great. And that's what he did. He turned the pages for the Chromalodeon. When Harry played it. Okay, so that worked out. And then he started, I invited him to the barge, and he came there, and we turned him on, which he'd never experienced. And, and he was driving a beat-up old car, and when he wasn't in his army clothes, he wore, like, really beat-up clothing. So we thought he was just another... old Bill and Buckwheat didn't really take him at the beginning. They thought he might be a drug agent or something. You know, we were very careful in those days.
Infiltrator, a spy, an agent, a police agent.
Yeah, I always have to forget about it. This guy is, he's a nerd.
you said that?
Yes.
Yes.
They don't use people like him. So he hung out and Jane befriended him, and he'd be there to eat with us, and we had this really beat up, I think it was a Ford Mustang, or some kind of a Ford anyway, and we didn't know anything about him.
And he didn't tell you anything, I guess?
He certainly didn't tell us anything about him. He was from Sacramento, California. What do we know? You know, it's like, what did I know? Did I have any idea who Anne's father was enough men in the world. She never believed it, by the way.
That's right.
Later,
yeah.
Later on, she said, "Of course you knew who my father was." Anyway, this is the same deal. We know who the Buck family is. No, we haven't. So eventually, one day, Jane is gone, and Adam and Radha are gone, and I don't know where they are. And I figure they'll be back, you know, the next day or that evening. And she doesn't show up, and we don't know where she is for like 2 weeks. And we notice that Bill Buck isn't around either. But eventually we find out that she and Bill Buck have gone to Nevada, and she's filing for divorce.
And has the kids.
Yes. And even at that time, we don't know that he's rich, you know. But very soon we find out who he is and where he comes from and so forth and so on. And
So did Jane get allured by the wealth she found out, or it had nothing to do with her running off with him?
Take on it is, of course she knew he had the money. Well, am I correct? She said, who would know? Nobody alive knows. They're both dead.
Right. Okay, so for 2 weeks you don't have your kids. I mean, that must have been pretty tough on you.
Well, it was weird, you know. It was weirder than tougher, because we were pretty busy doing Boo Bam Bamboo Drums and Harry Parts and KBFA, and you know, I thought maybe she went up to Eureka to visit her mother. I don't know what I thought, you know.
Well, where's the...
For some days it didn't strike us as being, you know, that she wasn't coming back.
Right. Now, you mentioned the bamboo drums, but before we just mentioned into that, are you having affairs while you're with Jane? Is she having affairs? Are you guys pretty
crazy? Yes, and yes.
Okay. So it's not a total shock that she would go off with someone else.
Hey, she went off with me, didn't she?
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And this kid is like nearly 20 years younger than I am.
Okay, so the bamboo thing, you invent a way of making some kind of bamboo instrument? What was that?
It came from working with Harry Parts. Now, oh God, we were building instruments. One of the instruments we were building was a marimba eroica, which goes down to 16, 17 cycles per second, so you can not really hear it. You can just feel it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a 4 foot by 8 foot by 18 inches resonator with a 4 by 12 straight fir grain block scooped out over it, hung on kind of bungee cord. And you play it with a huge mallet. I mean, huge, because it's soft. But, you know, so Harry and I can't figure out how to... He's sure the arithmetic is right, but we can't figure out how to couple the resonator with the block. You understand what that
means?
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay. All right, so I talked to old Bill about it.
Bill Buckwheat?
Bill Loughborough. Yeah.
Okay.
He's working at the Navy Yard. He says, oh, I can figure that out. And I don't know anything about this stuff. So he brings an oscilloscope and an audio oscillator, and we put through the plywood sides, we put a metal bar with wing nuts, and we squeeze the wood together a little, and the audio oscillator can imitate that many cycles per second or hertz. yet it's a couple using the instrument, and we see how the configuration of the resonator has to be. So that means that the block, which is supposed to play that, you know, that's one of three, really, but that was the big one, which was all the trouble. So we coupled it, and then we had to put mattresses and stuff on all the windows, because when you hit it, everything in the building that could shake shook, so you can't record it. Yeah, but we did record it finally.
And then that became something of interest to musicians or something.
Well, I mean, I used to bring the jazz musicians to Harry's studio, especially when we had a band playing, you know, rehearsing. I brought Stan Kenton and Chetty Baker and
Count Basie.
Count Basie and quite a few people. Stan Kenton. Stan actually bought Boo Bam's for it. So anyway, the Boo Bam drums were influenced by some of Harry's instruments. And
what's the blue band? I don't get that. What do you think? Blue band?
Blue band. B-O-O-B-A-M. It's bamboo backwards.
Okay, boo band.
The boo band bamboo drums.
Okay.
It's a poetic...
it's a Sternian. It's a Gerd Stern alteration.
So, anyway... Buckwheat is on this ocean liner going to the Philippines, and he brings us back these giant bamboo rods. And so we make two kinds of boo bam bamboo drums. We leave the nodes on either side of the piece, and then we cut an H in it, and we couple that with metals in it, and you know, you get two notes from the H cut. You got
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Okay, and in between we have pieces of bamboo which have no nodes, and those we put little heads on with screws to tighten up the skin heads. And we put those into like twos and threes, and the best ones are three at the bottom, another two, and then one, and they're all a half step apart. And we play them, and I have recordings of it.
Right now, is this inventing of this process attributed most to Harry, or you and other people?
We took it off Harry, and we decided it was a business we wanted to be in. Jack Simpson and I took the Volkswagen bus and went to Chicago to the music convention, and we sold a lot of them, but we didn't have them. They had to be made, and we couldn't get enough bamboo. I mean, it was all like, you know, a fantasy world, because, I mean, how many pieces of bamboo could Buckwheat bring? You know, on one
yeah.
voyage, right?
I think in the Bancroft oral history, you say you find out something later that if you'd known, you could have done it. What was that fact? I can't remember what it was. There was something in retrospect years later. You said, "Oh, we could have done that if we knew something." You don't recall?
Well, anyway, what happened eventually is after Bill Buck ran off
with Jane.
Yeah, after Jane took him for her ride, he started trying to buy up everything. So the first thing they did is they issued a little book of poetry by Jane and Bill Buck and her friend Wallace Luck.
Yeah.
Now, I had a book of poetry. Okay. The second thing is he tries to buy the barge through a third party. But somebody rats on him. He buys for a friend of Jane's to run the Anchor Steam beer brewery, right, in San Francisco. guy named Steve. He then finances Buckwheat and Bill and rents them a place not too far from the barge in Gate 5, and they start making bamboo drums out of redwood instead of out of bamboo. So, you know, this is not exactly amusing, but it's kind of bizarre.
He's redoing you.
Then he takes Jane to, in the meantime, he buys her a Mercedes. Now, in those years, Mercedes weren't, you know,
prominent.
That very many people had. And then he takes her to Thailand, Japan, India. They go on this big trip. They leave the two kids with Jack Simpson and his then nutty wife, and they get polio while they're in Thailand. Nobody has any idea of how to reach them.
You know? Wow, they get polio.
And Jack and his wife are not supposed to let me know anything about the kids. I don't see the kids at this point yet. That's the next stage. And they get polio. You know? So it's a frantic scene, and when they eventually come back, they're furious at Jack and his wife because they got in touch with me and the kids were in the hospital, and Bill Buck refuses to pay Jack what he owes him, which really was kind of a pisser because Jack didn't have any money.
You're saying that they're furious at him because he told you about your kids.
Yes, right.
Gee.
And I helped get him into the hospital and so forth and so on. But, I mean, you know. Anyway, Jack Simpson is still a friend of mine. We've been close friends ever before that and after that. He came from Kansas City. He's the one who introduced me to Bird, actually.
Bird, Charlie Parker, yeah.
Yes.
So, but what... So what happens with the kids? They've got polio.
What happens to them is that Adam winds up not only with polio but with muscular dystrophy and eventually dies from it. And Radha has just a very small case which eventually disappears.
So we know that Maya Angelou... You note your book of poems for her, 1955, July 55. So this has to be 53, 54.
Okay.
So that must have been terrible, have your kids get polio.
Yeah.
So did you speak to Jane and Buck or from that point on, or they're still...
Well, after they came back, they moved to... Stinson Beach, right?
Yeah.
And we got a big house, and we made an arrangement where I got the kids for the weekend. But, I mean, by that time, Adam was in a wheelchair.
Right.
Yeah.
And you have not seen Adam. I think you said...
Well, no, I saw him. I saw him at the hospital, you know.
But before then, when there...
Before then, I hadn't seen him.
For a year or two?
Well, it wasn't a year or two.
A year, maybe.
It isn't. Maybe not even, but who knows.
Right, so now...
Everything was very compressed.
Yeah. Now, what happens next? You see Radha? Does she come and stay with you?
Well, they come for the weekends. Well, now we're talking now about a period when I'm with Anne.
Right, but Maya Angelou was before then, so how does Maya come into your life?
She was a friend of Jack's.
Mm. And it was Jack who introduced you to Bird?
Yeah, but he also introduced me to Maya.
Right, so what is Maya doing at the time you meet her? Is she a performer?
She is just off the road with Porgy and Bess Company. She was the premier dancer in the company that was in Europe, Rome, and that she I had met her hardly before. She the name Angelou came from, I don't know if they were ever married, but they may have been married. At least they were together for some years when she was younger. His name was Tosh Angelos. He was Greek. A-N-G-E-L-O-S. And that's where Angelou came from.
Right. She's the same age as you, according to Wikipedia. She's born in 1928.
Yeah, but she's in very bad shape.
Now, yeah, just so people know who we're talking about, she becomes a really famous poet in the 70s, 80s, and she reads her poem at Bill Clinton's inauguration in 1993.
She writes it for him, and it's a lousy poem, and she's a lousy poet. and she was a great dancer, a great singer, and I like her prose writing, but a poet, I never cared for her work. And she wasn't writing poetry when we knew each other. She was a performer.
Well, why do you guys fall in love? What's the connection? How did it happen?
She was, I liked her work. I liked her. She was just off the road. She didn't have a place to live. She had a boy who was about, I don't know how old he was, 7 or 8 or 9. So she came to live on the barge with me.
And you're liking her, and then you fall in love, or are you already?
Well, we're a couple, you know.
Would you say you fell in love? Are you experiencing love with her? Would you say?
Like a vault, man. What do you expect me to recover stuff from that long ago? Of course, I loved her, but you know, can I tell you how deep it was, or what the temperature was? I don't think so.
Okay, good.
You know, sure, we had a great time together. I was her. If she introduced me to other women, it was, this is Gad Stern, my man and my manager. And if it was a man, it was, oh, this is Gad Stern, my manager and my man.
Okay, so now she's come off a stage thing, and then there's the purple onion, and there's the crowd scene, the club scene, the Blackhawk.
Yeah, the Purple Onion. We had a great bill. It was Phyllis Diller's first gig, Maya Angelou, and the Kingston Trio, who were also friends of mine.
But this was a new club. The regular clubs, more well known, were the Hungry Eye, and was there another one?
No, the Purple Onion and the Hungry Eye were the two big clubs.
And you're saying you started the
Purple Onion. The Purple Onion was at least managed and partially owned by one of the Barrymores, a gay Barrymore.
Right, but did you say you started the Purple Onion, or that you
didn't? No, I didn't start the Purple Onion. It was there. It was a popular night spot. It was like basically across the street from the Hungry Eye, practically.
So what did you mean about it being Phyllis Diller's first show and the Kingston Trio?
It was Phyllis Diller's first engagement was at the Purple Onion, and we had four acts, and Maya was one of them at the Kingston Trio, and Phyllis and this other young black chanteur, whose name I can't remember.
What did Maya do? What did she? How did she perform?
She sang. She sang and danced while she was singing. Don't let the sun catch you crying at my back door, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that was a great song in '64, the Mersey Beat sound. I don't know which guy it was, but the Beatles was seen.
This was much earlier.
10 years before.
And she looked fantastic. She was over 6 foot tall. She had a huge shock of hair. She wore, you know, very thin, long garment. Tank places in L.A. and so forth and so on. But it was, you know, we had lots of friends. Lena Horne. Lena Horne and Maya got on like, you know.
Twins.
Yeah, and her, and I loved her husband, Lenny.
Right, now, when you did the Bancroft Oral History, something you said about Maya's mother angered, you know, bothered Maya. Do you want to go into that a bit?
No. First of all, Maya, I don't think, knows about the oral history.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't know. It was, I made a mistake. Well, it had nothing to do with her mother. That was another old scene, her mother. Her mother had a little place called the Hot Dog in the Fillmore. And when the junkie tried to hold her up, she took out the gun from under her counter and shot him dead. And she got away with it.
Mm.
Self-defense, you know. Which is, but she was like that. She was gay. She had a living companion. And it was a little place, just like the counter. There wasn't even a space for table. But what the scene was, one day, I don't know, we got home very late. It was a club scene. We would get home at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Sometime in the middle of the night, she wakes me up. She says, your baby's so thirsty. Please get me a glass of water. I say, let me sleep, bitch. And she says to me, I'm making the second mistake with you. She says to me, no, okay, motherfucker, gonna call me bitch, you know. And she breaks this jar of peach, what is it called? Dixie peach on the floor, and she's about to threaten me with it. And then she starts crying, and she's bleeding. She says, oh, your baby's bleeding. Look what happened to me. So I got to bandage her up and et cetera, et cetera. This goes away. But I think to myself, hey, this ain't going to work. And that was really the end of the relationship. You know, we parted soon thereafter.
But you're saying, you start off saying you made a mistake. What's the mistake?
By telling that story in the oral history.
Because, well, what's the mistake?
Because it's not a nice story about...
Oh, okay. You feel bad about it now.
I feel bad about it now. I feel bad about saying it again.
but she does not know this. You assume that you said this.
I don't think she knows it, because we've seen each other a number of times since, and she's always very kind. And when I went to see one of her shows, I stopped after and said hello to her, and I said, you know, thank you a lot. She says, baby, what do you have to thank me for? I said, listen, I read all your books. You diss all the men you've ever been with, and you don't diss me. So she says, what was there to diss you about?
That's right.
She forgot that incident. I mean, you know, I didn't forget it.
So when did she in this, she performed, well, maybe let's go into a bit about the lifestyle. I mean, you were shunned by both the blacks and the whites by being with Maya, you know, on this nightclub scene.
Well, of a certain type, yes. I mean, not all blacks and not all whites, but I mean, China, for instance, in L.A., we had to stay in a black hotel, and the black sure as hell didn't like me being with her, you know.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, probably if we had had enough money to stay at the Beverly Wilshire or something, we could have done it. But in the class of hotels, they didn't want mixed couples.
In that class, yeah.
You know, in the medium class hotels, like, they would refuse you. Even
right,
if you had a reservation, they'd throw you out.
Right, the medium class, I get you.
Yeah, you know, Hiltons and places like that. In those days, the Hiltons weren't what they
you have a copy there of which book is it? Is it the first poems book you sign over, or you have Maya's copy? Right, and that's 55, and you have not met Anne at that point.
Well, I probably have met her, but she's with Sandy Jacobs when I meet her.
Right, and so maybe by 56, within the year, you're with her on the barge.
Right.
Very quickly after
Maya.
Did Maya, if you've read all her books, did she ever mention a barge in any scene like your what you live
no.
with her? Never come into her novels.
No.
So
they're not novels, they're memoirs.
Memoirs?
Yes, they're not novels. She doesn't write novels.
Now,
For Whom the Caged Bird Sings.
All right, and that is, she's got a huge inventory here, looking at her Wikipedia autobiographies. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, 69. Gathered Together My Name, 74. So a lot of these, they're all autobiographies.
Thank you.
Wow, she does, she talks about, are they in order? She starts with her youth, or?
Yeah. But she goes back and forth, too.
And she doesn't write poetry until 71, or the first poetry published. So in the 60s, before she writes I Know Why the Caged Bird Sing, what's she doing, writing and teaching? Or?
No, she was performing, and then she spent some time, I don't know if she was married or not. She's married now, but I don't know, they don't seem to live together. Or maybe he died. The last husband, but at the time she was either married to or with some kind of an African aristocrat.
Right. At what time was this?
In between.
After you?
After she was a performer and before she became a famous author.
I see, because she does do choreography with Al Vanelli, and she's involved a lot with the dance.
She was a student. I don't know if it's in her autobiography, in her Wikipedia, she was a student of Pearl Primus's.
Yes. It says she, from 59 to 60, she held the position of Northern Coordinator for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference at the request of Dr. Martin Luther King. So she starts to become an activist. She lived with a South African freedom fighter, Vizumi Maki, and moved with him and her son Guy to Cairo, where she became associate.
Okay, yeah. Guy.
And then she and Guy moved to Ghana, so she's doing Africa. She became an assistant administrator at the University of Ghana School of Music and Drama in the mid-60s. Then she became close friends with Malcolm X in Ghana and returned to America in 64 and worked in the civil rights. And then they say King was assassinated in 68. She did not celebrate her birthday, which was the day of his assassination, for many years for that reason. She sent flowers to King's widow every year until King's death in 2000, until Coretta King's death in 2006. Inspired by a meeting with her friend James Baldwin, cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer, and Pfeiffer's wife Judy, she dealt with her grief by writing her first autobiography, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, which brought to her international recognition and acclaim. So she got involved with activism in the late 50s, early 60s.
Right.
Were you in touch with her then?
Not till later, no.
And then she was writing poetry, too, and then she becomes mainly known as a poet later, right?
In a way, yeah.
Yeah.
But her books were much more popular than her poetry.
Right. It says here she did children's books. She did many plays, many screenplays and films, television.
Her best friend is Oprah Winfrey.
Ah, and is Oprah her best, vice versa?
I don't know. I don't know Oprah. I just know mine. She's in a wheelchair, and she's very badly crippled. And she's shrunk to practically half her size.
Wow, what kind of disease is it? What's she crippled from?
All kinds of arthritis and stenosis and, et cetera, et cetera. And for a long time, she drank her way out of the pain, which doesn't really work. And I don't know. She's, she doesn't fly. She has a house in Harlem, very beautiful house.
You've been there?
Yes.
Yeah.
And within the last year. But she spends most of her time where she lives down in the South, in Carolina.
Right. It says here, in 1998, she went on her first cruise, given by her friend Oprah Winfrey, in celebration of her 70th birthday. Over 150 people were in attendance. In April 2008, Angelou had three parties to celebrate her 80th birthday. A, quote, pricey soiree, unquote, that included a red carpet and a guest list of celebrities, in quotes, was held in Atlanta, Georgia, to benefit a YMCA youth center named after her. There was also a citywide event celebrated by Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and Winfrey hosted an extravagant 80th birthday celebration at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach, Florida. She was serenaded by Tony Bennett, Natalie Cole, Jesse Norman, she's an opera singer, and Ashford and Simpson.
Right.
They were pop singers.
Okay.
In 2002, she lent her name and writings to a line of products from the Hallmark Greeting Card Company. So she's quite an icon.
Yes. So what?
Beg your pardon? So what?
So what? So are you.
And you're becoming an icon in retrospective land, right? In museums?
I don't know if I can, you know, I'm not one of the icons on my desktop, I'll tell you that.
It says, in March 2008, Angelou stated that she planned to spend part of the year studying at the Unity Church. In 2005, she attended a Unity Church service in Miami and decided that day, quote, to go into a kind of religious school and study on her 80th birthday. Angelou became involved in U.S. presidential politics in 2008 by placing her public support behind Senator Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nominee, in spite of her good friend Winfrey's support of Barack Obama.
That's right.
So that's Maya. And so she was with you for, you could say, 2 years?
Not that long.
Okay. No. But what did, is there any particular music, jazz scene? Had you met Lenny Bruce by that time?
Had I met Lenny by that time? Yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It was when you were with Maya then, doing the club circuit. I think you tell that story. It was a strange club you guys go to, down in L.A. or someplace.
Yeah, but in the valley. But that wasn't with Maya. That was with Herb and Lorraine Geller. They were playing there. They were jazz friends of mine from New York.
But is it the period when you're living with Maya on the barge?
Hey, it may be maybe when I was with Ann.
Okay, now in 55 is when Ginsberg does Howl. I'll get the exact date. I mean, you have a copy of your own poems given to Maya. But you have the copy. You know, it's dated.
Because she left it when she left the barge, she probably left it.
All right. So, the Howl.
And there were very few copies left. So, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so Howl happens in, I think it's October. One of the most important events in Beat Mythos, known simply as the Sixth Gallery Reading, took place on October 7th, 1955.
Right.
So, were you one of the organizers of that, or was it a name?
No. I was there, but I wasn't one of the organizers.
Is it? It's in that performance that he takes his clothes off? I remember it.
I don't think so. No.
You don't remember that?
He takes his clothes off all the time, but I don't think he did it at the Sixth Gallery, no.
Right. So, what did you think of his poem that night?
I liked the poem. I was really pissed because of what he said about Carl Solomon.
Right, and you would hear it and know it. You'd be one of the few people who know who he was, who Carl.
Yeah, but I mean, the reason I was there was because Philip LaMantia and I were going to read John Hoffman's poetry, and Philip wound up reading it. I didn't. But he didn't read it. He was going to read his own poems and John, and I was going to read some of John.
But not your poetry?
No. And instead, Philip decided Reed.
So
I,
no,
I was there basically because of the John Hoffman thing. I mean, I knew Alan, as you knew.
Yes.
But I didn't. Nobody knew he was going to read that poem. That wasn't, you know, that wasn't the big deal.
That was a surprise. I mean, he had just arrived in the San Francisco scene, I think.
I don't know, just, but not too long, but I don't think it was just.
But he was not considered a phenomenal poet yet until that night.
He wasn't considered a phenomenal poet that night either.
Oh, is that right?
That night has gone down in history because of the people who were there and the fact that that poem did become so popular. It wasn't a big deal that night or thereafter until much later.
Was it a, were there poems similar to that?
No.
To his length?
You mean of his?
No, of other people at that night.
No, I mean people who all had their own style. I can't remember who else read that night. I really don't. I mean, maybe it was Jack Spicer, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's a sixth gallery reading. If I click on it, it was a Friday, conceived by Wally Hedrick.
Wally Hedrick. Okay. Yeah.
And it was a gathering of Allen Ginsberg, Philip LaMantia, Michael McClure, Gary Snyder, and Philip.
Oh, yeah, Michael and Gary, right, that's right.
And Philip Whalen.
And Phil Whalen, that's right.
It said McClure read Point Lobo's Animism, that was the title, and another one for The Death of 100 Whales. Does that mean anything to you?
Sure. I mean, we were great friends at the time, Michael and I.
Snyder read A Berry Feast. And Whalen read Plus a Change, Plus a Change, or Change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was before Phil went into that.
Right, it says Hedrick approached Ginsberg in the summer of 55 and asked him to organize a poetry reading at the Sixth Gallery. At first, Ginsberg refused, but once he'd written a rough draft of Howl, he changed his, quote, fucking mind, as he put it. The large and exuberant audience included a totally drunken Jack Kerouac, who refused to read his own work but cheered the other poets on, shouting, yeah, go, go, during their performances. Bill Carrick was able to recall much of what occurred at the reading and wrote an account that he included in his novel, The Dharma Bums. It says, the Sixth Gallery, founded by Hedrick, Deborah Remington, John Ryan the poet, Jack Spicer the poet, Hayward King, and David Simpson, was previously...
Hayward King, wow.
Beg your pardon? Oh. Hayward King.
Yeah, that, okay.
That's a name you hadn't heard in a long while?
Exactly.
Yeah, and it was previously known as the King Ubu Gallery, which was founded by artist Jess Collins in 1952.
Yeah, Jess lived with Bob Duncan for forever.
Jess, with Robert Duncan?
Yes.
Right.
He was a collagist, fantastic collagist.
It says that before its association with art and poetry, the King Ubu Gallery, it was an auto repair shop and is now a rug
king.
What?
Ubu Hua, right?
Yeah, yeah. What's his name? French poet.
Exactly.
I forget his name, but which was founded by... Okay, so the place was a auto repair shop and is now a rug store. Ubu Ro, there's several references to him in, I'm going to get the author, Alfred Jarry.
Alfred Jarry, yeah.
Yeah, there was references to him in Finnegan's Wake, and there was one poet I met years ago at the Finnegan's Wake group in New York who thought it really was based. Finnegan's Wake was like a major foundation of it, was Alfred Jarry. But I talked to James Joyce through the Evergreens, the medium, and he said, nah, that's just more stuff thrown in the stew. But, okay, so we want to move out of Maya, and now Anne comes into your life, and you've explained how it happened. And then you don't know, you're living with her, and then an article shows up in the paper about her. Was that like a year or so later of living with her, or very quickly?
It was after a while. We were living together, and she was called by this, I think it was the Chronicle rather than the Examiner, but I can't remember. photographer come out and they take pictures of the barge, barge living, right? And man doesn't get it, you know, that this is going to be something that her family is really going to dislike humongously, right? I mean, she should have been sensitive enough to realize it, right? So it comes out, and they flip out. Because it doesn't say whether we're married or not, but it's pretty obvious that we're not, right?
Yeah.
Anne London marriage would have been a thing on the society page in San Francisco, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, we had to get married, according to her, immediately. So we did.
But all this is new to you. She tells you why you got to get married, that she is the daughter of a rich king.
Well, no. By that time, I knew her parents. I knew who they were. You know, it's not a question of a secret, Bob. The question is that she thinks when we met and we first started going out together that I knew exactly who her father was, you know.
And plotted around that.
Not necessarily. No, she just couldn't believe that somebody who lived in the Bay Area didn't know who Dan London was. and it was through Anne that I met a lot of people like Herb Cain. I didn't even know who Herb Cain was. You think I read the Chronicle? You know, I don't read the New York Times now.
Right. I mean, basically, you're...
I wasn't a newspaper reader, and I still am not.
Yeah, you are, we won't say naive, but you live in a certain world, and you concentrate on that world you live in.
Anyway, so it wasn't a question of she didn't tell me until a certain point. I had, by that time, I had met her parents, and actually, we got along pretty well.
I thought that you didn't meet her parents until the article came out.
No. That's not true.
Okay, so they know she's living with you before the article comes out.
Oh, yes.
But they object to the article coming out, and that ruins everything.
Yes, I mean, they don't like publicity, except about Dan London, you know, Admiral of the Golden Fleet and Vice President of Western Hotels, which also was United Airlines, you know, and friend of the Shah of Iran, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That kind of publicity was fine, but, you know, his daughter living, he had two daughters. And he was a fashion model and living with somebody on a barge in Sausalito. It was not his style.
So, but this changes your life in terms of becoming aware of what strings and how PR happens, because through Herb Cain, you end up with Playboy, right? Are we jumping too fast when we go to Playboy?
No, that's right. Through Herb Cain, I wind up with Playboy.
And how does that happen? And have you met Lenny Bruce? I think you have met Lenny Bruce by that
Yes, I met Lenny Bruce by that time. I met him in L.A., but it was probably... It could have been during Maya, because Maya and we spent a number of times in L.A. It could have been at that time. But Maya didn't meet Lenny. Anyway, she may have been working. Who knows? I don't remember. But Herb Cain and his wife at that time, Sally, were friends of Anne's. And her family and other people and lots of people that she knew, you know. So Herb was trying to help me get a job. I didn't have a job. And he called me one day. He said, come on over, I'll show you something. So I came to his office at the Chronicle, and he said, look, I'm supposed to write this Playboy article about San Francisco. And they didn't tell me that it was a house-written article that they wanted called Playboy on the Town. I don't do stuff that doesn't have my name on it. You know, I just can't. It's part of my image. He says, so look, you write it. I'll tell Spektorsky that you're a good friend of mine, and I'm sure you can write it. And you don't care if your name's in Playboy or not, and they'll pay you. They'll pay you well. So I say, Herb, I don't know that world. How can I do it? He says, don't worry. I know that world. I'll introduce you to a few people. They'll take care of you. And he did. He introduced me to Frank DeMarco, who was the leading public relations guy for that kind of world in San Francisco. And Frank really took care of me. And I wrote the article, and Augie Spektorsky loves it. So I got to write more for them. But
you got what?
I got to write more articles, Playboy on the Town in Acapulco, Playboy on the Town in New Orleans. Anyway, so,
and you got to meet Spektorsky, who you were pretty impressed with, right?
I thought he was wonderful, yeah. He was. He was a great guy. And they wanted me to move to Chicago and work in the office, and I wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you do it?
Hey, I was living on a fucking barge in Sausalito. You think Chicago has something to offer you when you're living on a barge in Sausalito with Anne and having lots of friends? And why would I move to Chicago?
Right.
It's not exactly place that you want to live in, even now.
Right.
I mean, I didn't mind going there once or twice a year, taken out by Speck and his wife and Mr. Hefner.
Tell the story how Hefner comes to San Francisco and you introduce him to Lenny Bruce. But he had a weird character with him.
He had a nightclub owner. I can't remember his name. Nightclub owner from Chicago, a good friend of his. So, Augie calls me up one day and says, listen.
Augie is Spektorsky?
Augie. August was his name.
Okay.
But he was also called Speck. anyway, so Speck calls me and he says to me, Hef has never been in San Francisco. He's coming with this guy you don't know, but he's the nightclub owner here. He's okay. So you have to take care of him while he's there. You understand what that means? I say, yeah, I think I understand what that means. Show him around, introduce him to Herb. He's never met Herb, but introduce him to all kinds of people, and it'll be good for all of us. Okay. I had met him. But I didn't know him. I mean, I had met him in Chicago.
And this is 56, 57, when Hefner's not huge yet. Right?
Well, I mean, I think it was before the Playboy clubs and all that, yeah.
Yeah.
So they come to San Francisco, and I pick them up at the airport in my father-in-law's Cadillac. and I would take them around, and they behave very boorishly.
Both of them?
Yes. They drink too much. They wander around the streets flashing $100 bills at young ladies. They're very embarrassing. Okay, in the meantime, I had met Hef in L.A., and he was at the time, he wanted to be a movie script writer. But he was making, I saw him do his act at the Valley Club. And I saw...
You said Hef, you mean Lenny. You saw Lenny. Yeah. Wanted to be a scriptwriter.
Yes. Of course I meant Lenny, not Hef. I told this woman, Anne, who owned Anne's 440 Club, about Bring him up. Sounds like a good act. What was the sequence of that? Okay, so in the meantime, I had gotten another act before that. That was Johnny Mathis. That was another club that we got involved in after the Purple Onion. There's a block in San Francisco right in that part of town which was called the International Settlement. It was full of strip clubs. And there was a DA who wanted to close down all the strip clubs, so he closed them all down. And this one of the nightclub owners came to see me at the Onion. He had a woman and her sister were, he had a kind of menage a trois, which was his wife and his wife's sister. They were like brassy blondes, and they were the cocktail waitresses at the club. And he said, you know, he had that kind of funny talk. They're closing me down, and I don't want to be closed. It's no good having a place and being closed. So I want to change the way I run the place. Now, I know you know this world of the Hungry Eye and the Purple Onion. I want you to do the same thing for me. He says, don't worry, it's not going to be long. It'll be 3 months, 4 months, and we'll back to stripping. But in the meantime, you got a job, make good money, figure out what to call the place, and let's see what we can do. And I said, let me see the place. So I went to see the place, and like all the strip clubs, it has these long tables facing the stage with kind of stools behind them, you know? It's not like single tables or anything. I say, my God, I mean, how are you going to run this kind of club with that kind of seats? He says, don't worry. You get the good acts, people will come. Herb's a friend of yours, ain't he? He says, you get Herb here the first night and everybody will come. Okay, so I named it the Hollow Egg.
The Hollow Egg.
Yes, and the reason I named it the Hollow Egg is I bought about 200 of those hollow wooden eggs, you know, and I crammed the invitations to the opening into these hollow eggs and took them or sent them to all the important people in San Francisco. And it was Maya and Helen Noga and her husband ran the Blue Note, which was the jazz club. I was there practically every night. The two regulars were me and Ralph Gleason, the jazz critic. Now, Ralph couldn't drink. He had an ulcer, so they kept the milk and heavy cream for him. That's what he drank. Anyway.
So you did Helen, this little club.
No. Listen to this one. So Helen says to me right at this time, she says, good. I know you manage Maya, and you have all these connections. She says, I got this kid. You won't believe him. You won't believe him. He's just, I went to the high school graduation, and he was singing, and he'll knock your socks off. You got to help him get his first job. So 2 weeks later, this thing comes up. I call Helen. I say, hey, send your kid over. I think I got him. If he's really that good, he's got a job at the Hollow Egg. She says, Hollow Egg? I say, yeah, you know, it used to be the, you know. So anyway, so Johnny Mathis is on the bill. I mean, his first job.
Johnny Mathis.
Yes. And Maya Angelou. And, boy, we go down to L.A., this nightclub owner and I, and he's got a certain amount of contacts. says there's this dyke comedian. She is really raucous and dirty and funny. They'll love her in San Francisco. He says, but we got to go see the guy who is really promoting her in L.A. and Hollywood, and that's Edgar Bergen.
Right. So Ken is his father? Candace Bergen's father?
That's where I first meet Candace. She's a little girl.
Right.
And we go to see Edgar Bergen, and he says, yeah, sure. And the guy says, and will you come up when she opens? He says, of course I will. I mean, here's this patrician, wonderfully dressed, you know, Edgar Bergen.
Yeah.
With his accent. And so we hire this terrible woman. But she was funny. Edgar Bergen does not show up for the opening, by the way. And we had a couple of other acts, but anyway. So the Holloway. And Herb came. And lots of, you know, society. And they all got off on sitting in these funny tables. Because, you know, of course, none of them had ever been. Herb probably had, but most of the people had never been to the International Festival.